Welcome to today's Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American, read by volunteers at the Recording Library of West Texas. This production is also available at recordinglibrary.org and on the telephone reader by calling 432-617-5555.
Opinion. Texas View. Mental Health Services Line makes help more available. The Point. Like 911, a short, easy-to-remember number could make it easier for people in crisis. It's hard to imagine life without the 911 emergency number, or how many lives have been saved since the three-digit calling system was implemented beginning in the late 1960s. Patterned after the ATT 411 directory assistance number, 911 enabled people to access emergency dispatchers without having to learn or look up individual police, fire, or other emergency numbers at times of crisis when any delay could be fatal. The federal government is now developing a similar system for suicide prevention and other mental health issues. The Federal Communications Commission, FCC, in December, announced that it is creating a three-digit suicide and mental health crisis line. The designated number, the FCC announced, will be 988. We applaud the development. Like 911, a short, easy-to-remember number could make it easier for people in crisis or their friends or family members to find help when it's most needed. A current hotline exists, 800-273-TALK, 273-8255, but it's long and not easy to remember. A person could have difficulty finding the number and give up, rendering the search futile, and the frustration of the search could further fray a person's psyche when the person is most vulnerable. Making crisis calls easier is a vital goal. Data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, indicate that suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in America, roughly double the homicide rate. In 2017, the latest year with complete data, 1.4 million suicide attempts were reported, with 47,173 deaths. It's the second leading cause of death in Texas for people ages 15 through 34. On average, 129 suicides occur every day, and the high rate among military veterans and increasingly active duty military personnel is well documented. While those figures are high, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention considers the real numbers to be higher, since the stigma related to suicide coupled with inaccurate reporting probably lead to underreporting. Certainly, 988 is short and should be easy to learn, but it isn't notable enough to be easily remembered. However, the N11 system has been so successful and so popular that all available numbers already are dedicated to other services. For example, 211 is reserved for community services and 311 is for local government services. Funding is needed to bring the system into service, and legislation has been submitted in both the House and Senate. Unfortunately, the current contentious atmosphere in Washington and the attention being diverted to President Trump's impeachment has stalled much legislation, even bills such as this that have bipartisan support. We trust that lawmakers understand that delays could mean deaths and recognize the need to enact the measures that will bring the system online as quickly as possible and fund a publicity campaign that will help raise public awareness about the 988 number. The Brownsville Herald. To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach. Urine microalbumin. Dear Dr. Roach, I recently had to give a urine sample for microalbumin. Does it matter if I use the first part of the void or midstream? NF. Answer. Urine microalbumin is a test for small amounts of protein in the urine. It is most commonly used as a screening test for kidney damage due to diabetes. Very small amounts of the protein albumin, far less than what shows up on a typical urine dipstick, predict the onset of the kidney disease that can ultimately lead to dialysis. Positive microalbumin means that the diabetes may not have been under optimal control, and this is often treated with medications like ACE inhibitors, which greatly slow kidney damage due to diabetes. The very first few drops of urine often contain some cells of the lining of the urethra, and in the case of women, of the vulva around the urethra. Allowing that urine to void uncollected reduces contamination of those cells. This is particularly important when looking for infection, but is usually recommended for microalbumin as well. Hence, midstream is preferred. One study showed that the very first urine made in the morning is the most accurate way of looking for urine microalbumin. Local News Roundup. Police continuing to search for serial groper. The Odessa Police Department continues the search for a man who was reportedly involved in 12 groping incidents. All 12 reported incidents happened between July 4, 2019 and Monday at apartment complexes in the area of University and Oakwood Drive, 52nd and Tanglewood Lane, and Pembroke and Grandview, an OPD press release detailed. The man is reportedly wearing a bandana or a mask to cover his face and is targeting females who are alone at apartment complexes. In some of the incidents, the man is surprising the victims from behind before fondling them, the press release stated. In some cases, the man claims to be looking for a lost dog before fondling the victim. The incidents are reportedly being investigated as felonies and misdemeanors. OPD has released surveillance footage of the man, and it can be seen on its Facebook page at tinyurl.com/YHLEVLBQ. Anyone with information about the groping incidents is asked to contact the Odessa Police Department at 432-333-3641 or Odessa Crime Stoppers at 432-333-TIPS. Police asking for help to find forgery suspect. The Odessa Police Department is looking for a man who reportedly passed counterfeit money at a discount retailer. The reported forgery happened at 2:35 p.m. November 6th at the Dollar General Store, located at 2740 Grandview, an OPD press release detailed. Investigation reportedly showed a man passed a counterfeit $20 bill. OPD has released a photo of the man on its website at tinyurl.com/YEA2R9A5. Anyone with information about the forgery is asked to contact Detective L. Gonzalez at 432-335-3345 or Odessa Crime Stoppers at 432-333-TIPS and reference case number 19-36256. Man charged with burglarizing storage shed. A 62-year-old man was arrested after he reportedly burglarized a storage shed. Gilbert Richard Vasquez was charged with burglary of a building, a state jail felony, and criminal mischief, a Class C misdemeanor. The reported burglary happened at 9:01 a.m. Sunday in the 900 block of West 40th, an Odessa Police Department press release detailed. The complainant reportedly detailed to OPD officers that a man, later identified as Vasquez, burglarized their storage shed and damaged their fence before fleeing the scene in a Chevrolet Trailblazer. Another OPD officer saw a Trailblazer run two stop signs in the 3200 block of Pleasant Avenue, the press release stated. Officers stopped the vehicle and the driver was identified as Vasquez. The complainant reportedly positively identified Vasquez as the same person who who had burglarized their storage shed. The stolen property was returned to the complainant. Vasquez was arrested, charged, and transported to the Ector County Law Enforcement Center. He has two bonds totaling $5,500 and was still in custody as of Tuesday afternoon, jail records show. Endorsement. Creighton endorses Lacey. J. Ross Lacey, Republican candidate for Texas 11th Congressional District, announced Tuesday that his campaign has been endorsed by State Senator Brandon Creighton, Republican SD4. "I'm honored to endorse J. Ross Lacey for Congress," said Brandon Creighton. "Texas needs a conservative fighter in Congress who is committed to securing our border, draining the swamp, and standing up for President Trump. J. Ross Lacey is the conservative voice we need in Congress, and I am proud to support his campaign. I'm incredibly proud to announce that our campaign has been endorsed by Senator Brandon Creighton," said J. Ross Lacey. "Senator Creighton is a committed conservative who fights day in, day out for our values in the Texas Senate. It's an honor to have him on our team." Hospitality event set. The Odessa Chamber of Commerce will host a Discover Odessa Plus Odessa Friendly program January 22nd and January 23rd at the White Pool House. Hours will be from 1 to 4:30 p.m. January 22nd and 8:30 a.m. to noon January 23rd. Those attending can learn about the attractions Odessa has to offer its locals and visitors, and participants will tour a unique Odessa attraction. The event is free, but space is limited, so please RSVP as soon as possible. The trainings are hosted quarterly for the community. You must RSVP to attend by calling 432-333-7871 or email carmen@discoverodessa.org. The Odessa Chamber of Commerce website is odessachamber.com. Death notices for Wednesday, January 8th. James Alvin Nickel. James Alvin Nickel, 94, of Odessa, died Friday, November 15th. A celebration of life is scheduled for 10 a.m. January 10th at Asbury United Methodist Church. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa. Juan G. Rodriguez. Juan G. Rodriguez, 85, of Odessa, died Sunday, January 5th. Mass will be celebrated at 2 p.m. Thursday, January 9th at St. Mary's Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Luis Xavier Rios. Luis Xavier Rios, 70, of Odessa, died Thursday, January 2nd. No services have been scheduled. Arrangements are by American Heritage Cemetery, Funeral Home, and Crematory of Midland. Gary Daniel Thorpe. Gary Daniel Thorpe, 23, of Odessa, died Tuesday, January 7th. Funeral service is scheduled for 10 a.m. Thursday, January 9th at Acres West Funeral Chapel. Regional Needs Assessment Shows High Alcohol Use by Ruth Campbell. Following some uncertainty about state funding for the Prevention Resource Center, the program is still up and running. The youth prevention programs are going to be teaching new curriculum in Ector and Midland counties. The coalition programs, H2I and the Midland Coalition, have combined so they are now the Midessa Community Alliance Coalition, and it is going to serve both counties, Region 9 Prevention Resource Center Program Director Kayla Dubrava said. The scope of our program is also changing. We used to go out into the community all the time and just go to every meeting that we could and do every presentation that we could, no matter what it was. But now the state has really defined us as more of a support for the other programs, and so we're here to provide trainings for them, provide resources for them, and be their support and then also work with stakeholders in the community that can give data to us, Dubrava said. San Angelo now has a coalition called the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Council of the Concho Valley. Dubrava said that is the first time they have gotten one of those. The Prevention Resource Center supports prevention providers within the Permian Basin Regional Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse, PBRCADA, the youth programs, and the coalitions. PBRCADA covers Region 9, which includes 30 West Texas counties. It's our job to support them, so giving them the data that they need. Whatever kind of information they need, it's up to us to get that for them. We write our regional needs assessment, but also make sure that they get the trainings they need to provide services, Dubrava said. The regional needs assessment is issued every July, and a hard copy is available in September. The agency's website said the regional needs assessment is created by each prevention resource center in Texas, in conjunction with the Texas Department of State Health Services, every year. Data compiled for the report is gathered to provide the state, agencies and organizations, and the community at large with a comprehensive view of information about the trends, outcomes, and consequences associated with alcohol, tobacco, and other drug use in the region. Schools can still contact the agency for presentations, and each program has a different focus. We can still do presentations as well, Dubrava said. We're here to answer questions. If we can't do it, we can pass it on to whoever can. The executive summary of the regional needs assessment says consumption of drugs, including alcohol, starts at a younger age compared to youth across the state. Alcohol is still the most commonly used drug among youth in Region 9, followed by tobacco, marijuana, and prescription drug misuse. This is only partially reflected by student perception of harm, which ranks electronic vapor products as the least dangerous substance use, followed by marijuana use, alcohol use, tobacco use, and prescription misuse, the needs assessment said. Although alcohol violations have increased dramatically in schools across Region 9, its use is found more outside of school. In school settings, marijuana, tobacco, and electronic vapor products like Juuls and prescription drugs are seen more often, especially Xanax, the report said. The needs assessment said alcohol is still a glaring issue among adults in Region 9. Odessa and Midland are the top two cities in Texas for drunk driving deaths. Additionally, at any one time, there are approximately 353 people incarcerated for a DWI charge. Furthermore, every county in Region 9, with sufficient data, has higher alcohol-induced crude rates than that of the state. There were more than two DUI crashes every day in Region 9 in the year 2017, the assessment said. Dubrava said crude rates are not adjusted. She noted that alcohol is an issue in every age group and vaping is on the rise. We wrote about that last year even, but we got requests to hear more about it this year too. They told us that our special topic this year needed to be vaping, so we wrote about that just because it's so widespread and common and misunderstood, she said. We talked about how parents in general may be unaware of how accessible different drugs are and also how dangerous some of them can be. Region 9 has the lowest perception of harm for marijuana in the state, and parents share that. If we can increase that perception of harm, then we can likely decrease the rate of consumption. That's some of the takeaways our other programs can take with them, like what areas do they need to focus on. If we can increase perception of harm, the effects of these drugs are on people, how they work and what they do, especially at the youth stage, how vulnerable their brains are, and then it goes into behavioral health as well, Dubrava said. The effects of vaping might not be known for a while, and she noted there is still a lot of research to be done. But one thing's for sure, It's not healthy for you. They're seeing preliminary studies. They're seeing all different kinds of things. It may lead to this and it may lead to that. How does it affect their brain at such a young age? Youth who are vaping are now 6 times more likely to transition into using traditional cigarettes than someone who doesn't vape. Then also, of course, vaping illegal drugs and things like that besides tobacco or even tobacco-free liquids. There's still a lot of research to be done, but it's definitely not good. On the subject of opioids, Dubrava said there is a study from 2017 that shows Odessa is 15th in the nation for opioid use. But she said there are a few gaps in that study. That's for people who are prescribed opioids. It's also hard to gauge exactly how big of an issue we have, she said.
Hello. This is Kay reading the Monahans News for Thursday, December 26th, 2019. Front page. Former MPD officer pleads guilty to federal child porn charges. Sentencing to be held in March. By Christy Sullivan, staff writer. Former Monahans police officer Marshall Lacey Hobbs, 35, of Andrews, was arrested on November 26th. After he admitted to receiving pornographic images and videos from a 17-year-old Andrews High student with whom he was having a sexual relationship. The arrest came after a 2-week investigation by Texas Rangers and Andrews Police Department. Texas Rangers seized a cell phone belonging to Hobbs and executed a search warrant for that device, along with other devices and apps, according to the federal complaint. The complaint states Hobbs had a sexual relationship with an AHS student for months and received pornographic images and videos from her. Hobbs began working for the MPD on February 15, 2019, after an honorable discharge from Kermit Police Department. We hired Hobbs in February. He applied here looking to switch agencies, MPD Captain Christopher Quintana said. MPD Chief Billy Riley said, I was notified of the investigation by the Texas Rangers, and on November 13th, I called Hobbs into the office and asked him if this investigation would cause him to lose his peace officer license. Hobbs stated that it would, and I terminated his employment at that time. Riley added, during his employment with MPD, there was never an indication of anything inappropriate was going on with any minors in Monahans. If there had been, he would have been terminated immediately. Before coming to Monahans, Hobbs worked for Kermit Police Department as well as La Mesa Police Department. In a phone call to Lieutenant Richard Abalos of the Kermit PD, Abalos stated, Hobbs worked here for around 4 years and in his time here had no infractions, and no one has come forward since the news broke with any allegations regarding Hobbs. A phone call to the La Mesa Police Department was not returned as of press time. It is certainly a tremendous disappointment for our community to learn of the arrest of Marshall Hobbs by Texas Rangers for sexual misconduct with an Andrews High School student. Prior to his arrest, Marshall Hobbs was dismissed from the Monahans Police Department when he informed Chief Billy Riley that he would lose his law enforcement license, City Manager Rex Tay said. Marshall performed his duties as a police officer fine while employed with the Monahans Police Department, but unfortunately made some very serious mistakes in his personal life, he added. In September of 2003, Hobbs was arrested on a charge of theft, more than $50, less than $500, a Class C misdemeanor in Andrews County. We did a full background check on Hobbs and nothing came up on his report. Class C misdemeanors do not show up after 10 years, Riley said. On Monday, December 16th, Hobbs entered a guilty plea during a United States District Court hearing in Midland and sentencing is scheduled for March 11, 2020, in Midland, before U.S. District Judge David Counts. The felony offense carries a sentence ranging between 5 and 20 years in prison and a maximum $250,000 fine. Hobbs is currently out of custody on a $20,000 bond, pending sentencing, according to court records. According to the affidavit, the investigation began November 12th, when rangers were requested to assist Andrews PD after the victim made a statement to a school counselor regarding a police officer with whom she was having a sexual relationship. Officers later contacted the victim's mother at her residence in Andrews. The victim's mother said she learned of her daughter's relationship with Hobbs around 3 weeks earlier, and that she told her she didn't want her communicating with him, according to the complaint. The victim's mother then told us that she had found her daughter with a phone she is not allowed to have due to prior incidents, but she purchased it through a friend at work and took it from her, officers stated in the complaint. The mother then voluntarily gave us the phone. During an interview with officers, the victim confirmed she had been engaged in a sexual relationship with Hobbs for months, and that during the relationship, she had, on several occasions, transmitted nude photographs and sexually explicit videos of herself to Hobbs via internet apps. The victim also told officers that Hobbs responded to the images and never told her to stop sending them. Additionally, she said Hobbs told her to delete their conversations and all the images and videos. Soon after the interview, rangers seized Hobbs' phone. The ranger who seized the phone also told other investigators he had briefly spoken with Hobbs, and when asked about the victim, Hobbs told him that he didn't know she was 17 and that we would find stuff on his phone, according to the complaint. On November 13th, investigators obtained a search warrant for the victim's phone and found numerous images and videos of the victim in the nude and in sexually explicit videos. Also that day, officers retrieved an older iPhone from the victim's mother that was taken from the victim last year, the document states. The mother gave her consent as the owner of the phone to search and seize any evidence pertaining to this investigation, officers said in the complaint. Both phones were released to the DPS's Criminal Investigations Division to be downloaded for the investigation. Hobbs met with investigators in Andrews on November 18th, the affidavit states. Hobbs confessed that he did engage in a sexual relationship with the victim earlier in the year and that he never asked her how old she was until after the first time they had sexual relations, officers state in the document. Hobbs said the victim told him she was 17. Hobbs also confessed to receiving nude and sexually explicit photographs and videos from the victim on several occasions over the past month or so. Hobbs said at the time he was receiving the photographs and videos, he knew the victim was only 17 years of age and that it was illegal for him to be in possession of the material, investigators added in the complaint. Hobbs said upon receiving the illegal material, he would open the attachments, look at them, and on occasion respond to them with comments such as, "Nice." Hobbs said he would then delete them from his device and tell the victim to delete their message thread. Hobbs said he knew he was wrong and he was an idiot for doing it. On November 21st, investigators obtained a search warrant for records pertaining to a text app the victim used, according to the affidavit. Investigators conducted a search of the records, which included messages between the two, along with media files that included photographs and video files sent from the victim to Hobbs, it adds. While searching the records, I observed messages between the victim and Hobbs beginning on October 18, 2019, in which the victim first contacts Hobbs from the app, investigators stated in the affidavit. Hobbs asks, "Who is this? I have a message from this number, but I don't recognize it," to which the victim then identifies herself to him. Several days later, Hobbs messaged the victim, "So if you have had this phone for a while, why have you not sent those messages we talked about before? You know," the affidavit states. The victim then sent Hobbs a sexually explicit video of herself, it adds. More photos and video images were sent by the victim between October 22nd and November 11th, along with message exchanges. Based on the information contained in this affidavit, there is probable cause to believe Hobbs did knowingly and willingly receive child pornography, the document states. Gonzalez booked after stealing packages from residents, by Christy Sullivan, staff writer. Casey Jeanette Gonzalez, 40, of 805 East 2nd Street, was arrested on December 19th on a Ward County warrant for theft from person, mail theft, a Class A misdemeanor. According to Lieutenant Frarin Valle, Ward County Sheriff's deputies were dispatched to the 2400 block of West 15th Street after they received a call at approximately 6:24 p.m. regarding theft of a FedEx package. Through the course of the investigation, a suspect vehicle was identified. A deputy recognized the suspect vehicle and conducted an investigative stop at the Kentquick parking lot and identified the operator as Gonzalez, Valle said. The deputy saw the FedEx packaging in plain view, which matched the property that had been identified as stolen. Gonzalez was detained and questioned at the sheriff's department. A warrant was obtained for her arrest on the charge of mail theft, and she was booked into Ward County Jail on Thursday night. Bond was set at $5,000, and Gonzalez remains in jail in lieu of posting the bond. Carrasco Ortiz booked on charges of manufacturing/delivery. By Christy Sullivan, staff writer. Richard Damian Carrasco Ortiz, 22, of Monahans, was booked into the Ward County Jail on December 9th on charges of possession of marijuana less than 2 ounces, a Class B misdemeanor, manufacturing delivery of a controlled substance, penalty group 1, greater than 4 grams, less than 200 grams, and burglary of a vehicle. According to Monahans Police Department Captain Christopher Quintana, Officer Guzman responded to a call of a disturbance in the 700 block of South Alice Street. Upon arrival, Guzman observed Ortiz trying to fight with a black female, Quintana added. Ortiz was detained, and officers learned Ortiz broke into a vehicle at 715 South Main. Ortiz was seen breaking into the vehicle by the owner, and that's who he was apparently fighting around the corner when Officer Guzman arrived on the scene, Quintana said. Ortiz was also found to be in possession of marijuana, as well as in the possession of narcotics packaged up to sale, he added. Ortiz was subsequently arrested and booked on charges of possession of marijuana, manufacturing delivery of a controlled substance, and burglary of a vehicle. Bond was set at $30,000 for the manufacturing charge and $5,000 each for the possession and burglary charges. Ortiz remains in jail in lieu of posting the $40,000 bond. The case is still under investigation, and it's not clear if Ortiz will face more charges. King indicted for assault, family violence. By Christy Sullivan, staff writer. Jesse Xavier King, 32, of Alabama, was arrested and booked into Ward County Jail on December 12th on a Ward County warrant grand jury indictment for assault, family violence of family member impeding breath or circulation, a third-degree felony. The grand jury for the 143rd Judicial Court returned the indictment on September 26th. The indictment states that on or about April 23rd, King did knowingly and recklessly cause bodily injury to Angel Nicole Price, a person with whom the defendant had or had a dating relationship with, by intentionally and recklessly impeding the normal breathing or circulation of the blood of Price by applying pressure to her throat and neck. If convicted, King could face 2 to 10 years in prison and or a fine up to $10,000. Bond was set at $25,000. King posted the bond on December 12th and was released. As a condition of the bond, King shall not go within 1,000 feet of Price or any other complainant alleging assault, family violence, household member with previous conviction, shall not have any contact with her, her siblings, by writing, telephone, or any other means, nor send messages to any siblings, and shall not go within 1,000 feet of her residence. Desert Ridge Edition plans approved by MEDC. By Christy Sullivan, staff writer. Monahan's Economic Development Corporation board members approved the final plans for the Desert Ridge Edition in the East Monahan's subdivision. Ron Chestnut with LOA Investments was on hand for the meeting and presented the board with the final plans, which were recently approved by the city. The plan includes 344 lots for single-family homes, 90 standard lots for 180-unit multifamily duplex, and 24 corner cul-de-sac lots for an additional 48 units. It also includes 105-unit townhomes, 2 apartment complexes, the new elementary school, 8 commercial lots, a mobile home park with 100 lots, and the possibility of an additional mobile home lot or temporary RV lot for construction workers. All the development rides on us getting the Monahan's Parkway built. Once that happens, plans will be able to move forward, she said. A timeline on when the construction to pave Monahan's Parkway Street from 12th Street to Business 20 is still unknown. Board members agreed to a bid of $2.4 million to construct the 3,859-feet-long road. In other business, members tabled a buyback option of a 3.5-acre section of Block 27 to MKM Ventures, LLC, pending a contract from the attorneys. In January, directors approved the sale of the land to MKM Ventures, LLC, with the intent to build a Staybridge Suites Hotel. The agreed sale price of the property is $350,000. The contract stipulates that on or before October 31st, buyer is to pour a concrete slab for a minimum 3-story, 90-room flag hotel, and the structure to be completed on or before October 31st, 2021, to which they have not met the deadline, citing investment issues, MEDC Director Ashley Adalto said. The property sold to MKM Ventures is the majority of Block 27, with the exception of a section noted as 200 feet by 260 feet on the front east side of Block 27, which was sold to Ever and Marielena Sainz at a price of $40,000 for a new coffee shop. Construction for the coffee shop is well underway, Adalto noted. In regular business, the directors approved accounts payable for the month of November, totaling $169,976.70, which included $160,000 to Security Preferred Title for the 8th and Main Street property closing, $7,258.13 for payroll salaries, and $200 to Swanner Photography for website photos. The financial report reflecting a balance of $3.2 million in available funds and minutes of the November 18th meeting were approved. Directors present were Larry Bryant, Richard Irwin, and Camilla Blum. Oscar Fuentes and Brian Franks were absent. Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for December 19th, 2019. Front page. As Leach's trial continues, District Attorney and Airbnb take note. By Stephen Paulson. STEPHEN at BigBendSentinel.com. Alpine. It's been a little over 3 months since Jeff Leach, a prominent Terlingua man and founder of Basecamp Terlingua, filed a defamation lawsuit against an alleged assault victim. Katie Milam, a former employee at Basecamp, told police in July that Leach had allegedly pinned her down and told her he gets what he wants. In a lawsuit filed in September, Leach accused her of extreme and outrageous conduct and making false defamatory statements. Then, in November, two more women gave affidavits accusing Leach of sexual assault and rape, as the Big Bend Sentinel first reported. One woman alleged Leach raped her. Another alleged Leach sexually assaulted her. The Big Bend Sentinel also reported on a fourth woman who received a temporary restraining order in 2017 after Leach allegedly threatened her. That woman has not responded to requests for comment. The defamation lawsuit was set to have a hearing last week, but that did not happen. Instead, Judge Roy Ferguson reportedly recused himself. At press time, Brewster County courts do not yet have any records on Ferguson's recusal, and Ferguson's office did not respond to a request for comment. Ferguson is the judge who granted the fourth woman a restraining order in 2017 after Leach allegedly threatened her. As the case unfolds, authorities and at least one company are watching. Since reporting our initial story, the Big Bend Sentinel has filed multiple records requests with the Brewster County Sheriff's Office and District Attorney's Office seeking information about Leach. In an email to the Big Bend Sentinel, Brewster County District Attorney Sandy Wilson says she could not provide records on Leach because she's using them in the detection, investigation, or prosecution of a crime. Last month, an Airbnb spokesman also confirmed to the Big Bend Sentinel that it had kicked Leach off its website as a result of the sexual assault allegations. Leach was previously a super host on the vacation rentals site. Court filings from this month offer more context on that termination. In an email dated November 22nd and attached as a court exhibit, an Airbnb employee tells Leach the company has decided to remove him after a routine review. He cites the Big Bend Sentinel's previous reporting on multiple sexual assault allegations against Leach, which he says violate Airbnb community standards. Meanwhile, Leach's defamation case against Milam, who also goes by Schwartz in court filings, has continued. Leach's lawyer, Ray Lifesti, earlier this month filed court documents disputing the allegations made by Milam and the other women. In it is an affidavit from Jeff Leach. I did not force myself on or assault Katie Schwartz in any way, he states. Instead, he states that any contact between us was totally mutually consensual and that it never progressed beyond making out. He states he had multiple pleasant communications with Milam after the alleged assault when he was apparently still her boss. He states he had consensual sex with the woman who filed an affidavit alleging he raped her, including on the date of the alleged rape. That woman has asked the Big Bend Sentinel not to publicly identify her in our reporting. The filing includes a photo of one alleged victim with Leach after the alleged assault occurred, which is presented as evidence that the assault did not happen. It also includes multiple affidavits from women, including Leach's girlfriend, disputing the alleged victim's versions of events. Malum's lawyers, Jody Cole and Liz Rogers, have continued to argue in court filings that Malum has a legal right to speak publicly about her alleged assault. They have also filed more of their own affidavits, including from a base camp employee who states she saw Leach doing mushrooms and marijuana at work, and from a man who states Leach allegedly attacked and injured him at a construction job in 2018. In another filing from last week, Cole and Rogers also showed Leach had been arrested for allegedly assaulting the fourth woman, who later obtained a restraining order against him. In an incident report from September 2015, a deputy with the Brewster County Sheriff's Office responded to a property in Terlingua after that woman called 911 to report she'd had an altercation with her boyfriend and was worried he will come back. The woman told the deputy that Leach allegedly went off on her for no apparent reason, began throwing things around the house, grabbed her and shoved her around, and then left, according to the report. The woman called her brother, who attempted to block the door to keep Leach from entering the residence after Leach returned. Leach allegedly grabbed him by the wrist and shoved him against the door, the report states. The deputy said the woman was visibly shaken. In his report, he said he'd tried to question the woman, but that she was extremely evasive and made it clear from her answers that she didn't want to get Leach in trouble and was trying to protect him. Her brother made a voluntary statement to authorities corroborating her version of events. When the deputy questioned Leach at his home, Leach said the woman had jumped on him and attacked him, allegedly hitting him on his neck and head around 20 times, he said. But the deputy found no signs of a struggle on Leach. He determined Leach to be the aggressor and arrested him for assault, family violence. In follow-up court filings from that woman, which are also included in Colin Rogers' filings, she also alleges Leach assaulted her at least twice more, once in Terlingua in March 2016, when he allegedly threw her on a bed and rubbed blood in her face, and once in Paris in September 2016. Another court hearing is scheduled for January 10th. Marfa's Blackwell School joins the National Register of Historic Places by Abby Perot, ABBIE at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa. Marfa's historic Blackwell School, a reminder of school segregation, received an honorific designation to the National Register of Historic Places for its significant contribution to the broad patterns of our history, according to the application approved by the National Parks Service on December 4th. The Blackwell School, built at the turn of the 20th century by Presidio County and the local school district, provided primary school education to Marfa's Hispanic children at 501 South Abbott Street in what is now South Central Marfa. Despite mandated segregation for African-American students, there was never any national or state mandate to separate Hispanic students from their Anglo counterparts. Instead, the proliferation of segregation between those communities was de facto, mostly put into place by local school districts, and was not legally undone when the Supreme Court desegregated Anglo and African-American students. Blackwell educated Marfa's Hispanic elementary and junior high students until 1965, when a new elementary school was constructed and Marfa's education system was integrated. Bonnie Wilson, a historian at the Texas Historical Commission who worked on the Blackwell application, says, "We did not look at this nomination as precedent-setting, and we recognized that this property is unique because it tells the story of Texas Hispanic children's education, which is not a topic that is often covered. Blackwell covers multiple underrepresented subjects: ethnicity, nationality, primary school education, and Marfa's location, Wilson says. It covers an uncommon combination of subjects compared to other designated historic places. Lionel Salgado attended Blackwell from 1941 to 1951, a time he recalls for its good education, good teachers, and good memories. But today, Salgado reflects on the school's legacy in Marfa and is troubled. A lot of it has been ignored and forgotten, and more ignored than forgotten, Salgado says. People, for some reason, don't want to think about it, but it's part of history. One thing I talk about is how burying our past hasn't worked, says Gretel Ink, president of the Blackwell School Alliance. Ink brought her background of nearly 20 years' experience working with the National Park Service to her role at the Alliance. Ink previously worked at the Manzanar National Historic Site, the location of America's Japanese internment camps during World War II. I saw the power of that place being preserved and people being encouraged to tell their stories and really reclaim their voice around the violation of the Constitution that happened with internment, Ink said. The Blackwell School is a very different story, but at the same time, it's coming from the same place, devaluing people who are different from the people in power. Ink says, I just believe very, very strongly in the power of storytelling and people being able to claim their stories. When she speaks about the past being buried, there's one literal instance that many Blackwell students recall. The application for the National Register includes a narrative about a 1954 incident at Blackwell where students buried Mr. Spanish. A seventh grade class was instructed to write, I will not speak Spanish, on paper scraps, place them in a coffin, and, during a school-wide gathering around the flagpole, bury the box in a ceremony. The teacher later explained her intention was to help students learn English and lose their accent. After the burial, students were paddled for their language transgressions. As Maggie Marquez recounted to the Big Bend Sentinel in 2007, the school's principal paddled the young student after she told her classmates, Nadia, me va quitar mi español. No pueden hacernos esto. No one's going to take away my Spanish. They can't do that to us. Even some of our grandkids didn't even know about it. Some of the students' grandkids, Salgado says about Blackwell and its history. I've mentioned it to my grandkids. I'm proud of it. It happened, and it's part of history. By not mentioning it, it's not going to go away. It happened. Recently, Blackwell has initiated an effort to bring today's Marfa students into the space to educate them on Marfa's past. Compiled over 3 years, the application to the National Register included narratives from former students and teachers, which it relied on heavily since, according to Ink, the school district burned the Blackwell records in the 1950s. Along with oral histories, the application detailed a historic structure report of the two remaining Blackwell school buildings. The other structures were destroyed to make way for low-income housing after the school's closure. It even answered one long-standing mystery: when the Blackwell School was actually built. Late local historian Lon Taylor had volunteered time doing deed research for the Blackwell School Alliance, uncovering documents that disputed a long-running oral history that Blackwell was built in the 1880s. The deed revealed the founder of Marfa, John M. Dean, sold the Blackwell land to the county in 1909, and construction began immediately after. The physical building is crucial to its placement on the register. Wilson says it is representative of that face of Marfa that we might not see. It's the face of the Marfa community and is still, symbolically, an important place for that community. Though segregated Hispanic schools were prolific across the Texas-Mexico border, few remain standing, much less in their near-original condition. Blackwell's addition to the National Register of Historic Places opens the school up for tax credits to complete renovations and improvements. It also broadens grant opportunities, which the Alliance could use to implement more exhibits in the space and toward their goal of hiring an executive director this year. The Permian Basin Area Foundation and its Tillipah Public History Fund have already contributed $25,000 toward the position's salary. Wilson, the historian from the Texas Historical Commission, says Blackwell is likely the only segregated Hispanic school on the register in Texas. In Alpine, the segregated Centennial School is an office building. In Marathon, the Hispanic schoolhouse is eroding into the ground. Fort Davis building is gone. Blackwell's endurance is key to preserving the history of Texas segregated Hispanic border schools. In 2006, a group of alumni formed the Blackwell School Alliance and fundraised to repair the building's exterior. Today, visitors can explore the schoolhouse during open hours and learn more of its history. What we're understanding now is that we preserve an incredibly authentic physical space that is the portal to connecting to a much bigger story, Inc. says. The ongoing American conversation around identity and othering and all of those other things that we really have both the obligation and the opportunity to speak to. Part of it is that nobody else is doing it. Blackwell presents the real history of Marfa, the Hispanic history of Marfa, which might not be as well known as the contemporary art history that's going on in Marfa right now, Wilson explains. This nomination illuminates this history about a popular, well-known city that a lot of people don't know unless you grew up there and lived there. When Wilson mentions location as a unique factor in the Blackwell application, she's speaking about the booming tourism and art scene that a tiny remote town in West Texas somehow came to possess. Wilson says the outsider's perspective of Marfa today differs from what Blackwell is presenting. The designation itself tells the rest of the nation this place is important, the historian says. It has critical importance and meaning to people who grew up and lived there, who made friends, whose family lived there. It's more than just a school. It's an integral part of the Hispanic community's culture and their past. It's not just a segregated story. It's about that community, their family and friends, and all the opportunities the school gave them. Salgado credits the Blackwell Block Party as one of the greatest things that happened at the school because it brought all of the people of Marfa together and it gave us a chance to show the people of Marfa that we are in this together, Salgado says of the yearly event. That's the idea of being one community together. Together we can do a lot of things. The Block Party is going to grow in 2020. Along with the April 25th celebration, a series of meetings on April 23rd and 24th will gather community stakeholders to address conflicts and seek resolution through a series of gatherings. These will be facilitated public meetings where the Alliance plans to listen, brainstorm, and receive input. Now we're on the National Register. What do we do with that, and what do people want to see happen here? Inc. says. How do we make sure all of the voices are heard, the divergent, challenging voices? Inc. asks. Let's hold space for that, too, because if this is going to work, it's going to require all the support of all of Marfa. And I think there's hope for that. Burying our past has not healed our community, Inc. says. If there is a way that the Blackwell School can be a place to really hold space for all the emotions and conversations, that would be a dream come true, if that could somehow lead to some healing and dialogue. I do think that having this designation of the National Register is one step toward claiming our authority on being that place, she says. We have our Texas landmark, but for every one of these designations we get, it is like someone saying, that is really important to our understanding of American history. And hopefully people are more comfortable talking about it.
That's all for today's Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American, a production of the Recording Library of West Texas. You can also hear this program anytime online at recordinglibrary.org or by calling the telephone reader at 432-617-5555.